1989, he won the $20 first prize in an LA Times speech contest. His entry denouncing a wave of indifference to the Constitution, ironic only in retrospect. Inside the new library, the story now starts with high drama, an unforgiving Watergate exhibit kicked off by the Nixon comment, "This is a conspiracy." The previous Watergate exhibit, which Nixon helped develop, suggested the crisis was orchestrated by Democrats to overturn his 1972 landslide election. His defensiveness was clear in his 1973 "I Am Not a Crook" speech.
And I want to say this to the television audience. In all of my years of public life, I have never profited from public service. I've earned every cent because people have got to know whether or not their president is a crook. Well, I'm not a crook. I've earned everything I've got.
More than 70 new exhibits, the website offers an overview, help carry the narrative from there. Take a selfie at the Great Wall during Nixon's trip to China, or visit the Oval Office circa 1969. Sit at his desk and wave goodbye to the White House on the last helicopter ride. But many classic exhibits remain, such as the 1957 letter from Martin Luther King thanking Nixon for his civil rights advocacy, and the rotating display of strange, sometimes hilarious gifts sent by just plain folks. Speaking of gifts, the museum shop here is as good as ever, still the place for the President and the King kitsch, those Nixon and Elvis t-shirts, note cards, and refrigerator magnets. Until next time, this is Kim Ware for Up the Road.
This is KZFR FM 90.1 Chico, California, community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And you are listening to Ecotopia, exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological. Today we'll open with some recent news on the topic of environmental justice, and then we'll speak to Chico activist and KZFR programmer Chris Nelson about a recent vigil and ask her about the importance of the UN Declaration of Universal Human Rights.
Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Lily's Brazilian Bistro, offering traditional Brazilian cuisine made from fresh, locally sourced, organic ingredients in the heart of downtown Chico. Lily's Brazilian Bistro serves traditional Brazilian dishes as diverse, exciting, and colorful as Brazil itself. Located at 142 Broadway, open Monday through Saturday from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. with dine-in and outdoor seating. More information, including to-go orders and reservations, at 530-399-0675 and on Facebook and Instagram. Ecotopia is also made possible by you, the generous supporters of KZFR, and by Chico Performances, presenting Jazz at Lincoln Center, performing Songs We Love, a musical journey through the history of jazz music from the 1920s through the 50s. The world-renowned performers of jazz at Lincoln Center take the stage with three vocalists to celebrate the songs of the early jazz era made famous by Frank Sinatra, Billie Holiday, Ella Fitzgerald, Judy Garland, and others. The concert is on January 24th in Laxon Auditorium. More information at chicoperformances.com. And we want to remind you that the opinions voiced on this program do not represent the opinions of anybody else. I can tell you who it doesn't
all
represent.
All kinds of people.
The staff, board of directors, underwriters, programmers, or volunteers. That was Aretha Franklin, Respect. We think that most of our listeners have heard about and thought about the concept of environmental justice, but we've also found that it's a term we use somewhat casually. So we thought we'd use the first part of the program to sharpen our own sense of what it is. Wikipedia, often helpful in such matters, provides this background. Environmental justice is a social movement to address the unfair exposure of poor and marginalized communities to harms from hazardous waste, resource extraction, and other land uses. The movement has generated hundreds of studies showing that exposure to environmental harms is inequitably distributed.
The Wikipedia description continues that the movement began in the United States in the 1980s, was heavily influenced by the American Civil Rights Movement. The original conception of environmental justice in the 1980s focused on harms to marginalized racial groups within rich countries such as the United States, and was framed as environmental racism. The movement was later expanded to consider gender, international environmental discrimination, and inequalities within disadvantaged groups. As the movement achieved some success in more affluent countries, environmental burdens have shifted to the global south, meaning the southern part of the world, as, for example, through extractivism or the global waste trade. The movement for environmental justice has thus become more global, with some of its aims now being articulated by the United Nations.
So we followed up on that reference to the UN and found this article by Francine Pickup, Deputy Director of the Bureau for Policy and Program Support of the UNDP. Human-induced climate change is causing weather and climate extremes across the globe, putting pressure on already strained food systems and causing mass displacement. Human action and consequently human inaction have led us to triple planetary crises of climate change, pollution, and biodiversity loss. All this has had a severe impact on human rights, which includes access to adequate food, water, education, housing, development, and life. It is widening social and gender inequality and leading to violence and marginalization.
UNDP, that's United Nations Development Program, Francine Pickup continues, these impacts of the planetary crisis are disproportional. Developing and least development countries are most affected, despite contributing the least. In addition, disadvantaged and marginalized groups are hit the hardest with less ability to adapt to the consequences. In response to the accelerating impacts of this crisis, a global movement has grown, powered mostly by young people, supported by science, urgently demanding action to address the climate emergency. This raised awareness and civic mobilization is critical to push for the radical kind of change needed. But still, governments, businesses, and institutions are falling woefully short of their needed response.
The UNDP, that's a United Nations Development Project, believes that these structural inequalities and poverty must be addressed through environmental justice to prevent and eliminate environmental inequalities where the most vulnerable are the most affected. To accelerate the global advancement towards environmental justice, countries need global acceleration of environmental rule of law to ensure that governments respect, protect, and fulfill the right to clean and healthy environment, which is the key for sustainable development. And we need to ensure that businesses and institutions also play their part. Strong national legal frameworks to help spur equitable and sustainable management of natural resources. These legal frameworks need to incorporate vulnerable, excluded, and marginalized communities to access justice, information, and participate in decision-making.
And again, these are the recommendations of the United Nations Development Program, what we need to do to advance environmental justice. They continue, accessible justice and human rights institutions that will enable vulnerable, excluded, and marginalized people and communities to access justice and information and participate in decision-making. Women and indigenous people are powerful agents of change and environmental justice advocates if they are allowed the space or platform for their voices to be heard. They also say we need gender equality in land management. Women should have a critical role in the management of land and natural resources and climate action. Yet, in many countries, laws and customs limit their freedom to claim and protect these assets. And they recommend transformation in the way we think about the rights of future generations and the rights to a healthy environment. It needs to incorporate wide cross-sections of society in the design of environmental policies and decisions. And again, that from the United Nations Development Program, an article by Francine Pickup.
This is all really abstract. This is on the level of thou shalt. These are things that we hope for, we wish for, we dream for, but we need to look at examples of groups who are actually doing that kind of work in their communities for environmental justice to see what the potential is for creating this kind of a system. So here's one. In Texas, Downwinders at Risk Education Fund is dedicated to taking effective action on behalf of those being harmed by air pollution. And they say, our goal is to build a strong grassroots constituency and create new strategies for clean air in North Texas. We do this by informing, connecting, and mobilizing citizens to become active participants in the decision-making that affects the air we breathe. In doing so, we improve both the quality of our air and the quality of our democracy. We're committed to working for environmental justice with communities impacted by the worst pollution, to deliver the best science to those communities, to making decisions about pollution and polluters more democratic, and to providing solutions to the problems we spotlight, and to funding staff devoted to grassroots empowerment.
For example, and here we're continuing from the Downwinders at Risk website, one of the groups that they work with, the Southern Dallas Neighborhood Self-Defense Project is an effort to use the official citywide Forward Dallas Comprehensive Plan process to reverse decades of racist zoning in Southern Dallas that has put people of color dangerously close to polluters. And we'll get another example of this a little bit further on in this description. The group provides assistance to neighborhood organizations in the creation, adoption, and implementation of grassroots land use plans that expressly reflect the community's vision. Their goals include implementing an equitable process for the rapid approval of neighborhood-led land use plans by the City of Dallas. Residents, they say, must have their voices heard. That might be somewhat in contrast to Chico and the current debates over Valley's Edge,
where residents are not being heard.
But we continue. The Self-Defense Project, removing industrial zoning in southern Dallas, where the current land use is not used for industrial uses. They want to redraw the map of where polluters can locate in Dallas. And they want to prohibit new polluters from locating in the Trinity River floodplain, and a timetable for removal of polluters still doing business there. Flooding and toxins should not mix.
And so this is kind of typical of what happens to poor people. They end up in places, and this is true in Chico as well, they end up in places that are the most dangerous, the most at risk, the most affected by pollution and other kind of negative consequences of poverty. But the Downwinders at Risk has another project, And they highlight this one. And this one took place in a southeast Dallas neighborhood of Floral Farms, hardly a Garden of Eden in terms of environmental justice. The neighborhood was settled in 1872 by black people who had been enslaved and is now predominantly black and Latino. In the past, it was and has been redlined as an undesirable black residential area and targeted by city planners for industrial pollution, railroad depots, concrete batch plants, roofing manufacturing, and a massive landfill. The Floral Farms neighborhood-led area plan was created by Neighbors United, Vecinos Unidos, formed in late 2018, and has been fighting to address the environmental and community injustices in Floral Farms ever since. The group is led by resident activist Marsha Jackson, with representation from every residential street in the community. One of the recommendations in their neighborhood-led plan is the creation of a community gathering place and park to help the community heal after Shingle Mountain. They have been working towards making the Park for Floral Farms dream a reality.
So what, we wondered, was Shingle Mountain from which the community is healing? Well, it turns out that in that same neighborhood, in 2017, two white business partners schemed to dump discarded roofing shingles on a road leading to the landfill, disregarding the state and city permit process. As the pile of shingles rose for 2 years, city officials failed to take action, and of course the neighbors started calling it Shingle Mountain. Fine particulate matter, including fiberglass, filled the air around people's houses, so they nicknamed it Shingle Mountain. It took 2 years and much negotiation, but Shingle Mountain has been removed. As a matter of fact, in terms of environmental justice, we read that the contractor who was finally contracted to remove the shingles took special precautions to ensure that the workers were fully protected, assuming once again that the workers were probably not from the upper financial classes of Dallas. So made sure they were protected from toxins and dust and other harmful elements that were generated by the shingles.
Here's another example of environmental justice. Sorry. Okay, I'm ready. At the middle school level. This is an article in Edutopia by Susie Boss and highlights the work at Lanier Middle School.
Faizia Alam, a science and math teacher in Fairfax, Virginia, believes that environmental action projects prompt kids to ask what they can do to make a difference. They won't remember worksheets, but they do remember learning by doing, she says. Schools and districts that are leading the way with climate projects are ensuring that such memorable learning experiences reach all students. This is kind of work has been around for a while, too. I was a member for a while of Science, Technology, and Society Education Group, and people were doing all kinds of stuff. I remember specifically a project called CPUP, Chemical Education for Public Understanding, where instead of just teaching ordinary chemistry, science teachers sent kids out into the neighborhoods with tongue depressors coated in Vaseline. And they put these around and then looked at the particulate that accumulated on those. And lo and behold, they discovered that the heaviest particulate areas were those in the poorest neighborhoods. So Alum and her colleagues at Lanier Middle School use their campus as the focus for watershed projects that engage students in making scientific observations and designing solutions. Since 2010, so this is not a brand new project, students have remediated parking lot runoff, they've installed rain gardens, they've helped redevelop an unused courtyard as an outdoor classroom, collaborated with city and nonprofit partners on a wide range of environmental projects.
Lanier students frequently present their proposals.
Oh, we've both been sick recovering, so we'll just cough a little bit. They frequently present their proposals to the school board, state politicians, and expert judging panels. Some efforts result in funding to put proposals into action. After students research the impact of plastic waste, for example, they proposed installing filling stations for reusable water bottles. An organization called EarthForce, which combines environmental education with civic skill building, awarded funding to install six stations. Students then went to the school board, asked for funding for three more of these water bottle filling stations. Alum says they presented data to make a convincing argument. The school-wide focus on environmental projects started with small steps, says Alum, but with support from school and district leaders, her passion for environmental action, along with her students' enthusiasm, has spread across content areas. At Lanier, environmental projects typically begin with science but become the focus of language arts classes when students move into proposal writing. Social studies teachers also use watershed projects to introduce the history of the Chesapeake Bay. Some projects also integrate the arts. The outdoor classroom has become a focus of visual arts project, and public events often feature music performances that celebrate nature. Environmental projects extend beyond school hours, too. An active eco club gives students the opportunity to continue working on environmental service projects outside of class. This includes advocating for solar panels on school rooftops. The school has been recognized for its school-wide efforts with a Green Flag Award from the Eco Schools USA program of the National Wildlife Federation. It's all connected. This has become our culture, says Alum. And this sort of multidisciplinary project, it's dear to our heart. And I know that there are projects like this going on in Chico area schools as well. The beauty of these is that they get so far away from the typical obsession with test scores and skill and drill. But as you think about these projects, think about reclaiming the tarmac in a school parking lot. When kids start to work on this, they're going to, in my opinion, they're going to learn every bit of math they ever need for the rest of their lives. They're going to learn to calculate. They're going to do square footage. They're going to figure out the volume of the water that's being sent down the drain. They'll know everything that they need to know in mesh, getting away from skill and drill, times tables, and all that that good stuff. Similarly, in history, when Susan and I were teaching, one of our mantras was that history beats a path to your doorway every morning. So if you look at watershed projects right around the school, you're going to get into the history of Chesapeake Bay, the streams. Where are they coming from? Where do they go? Projects integrate the arts. There's a lot of talk about how arts and arts education, arts can actually influence change, and we've done a couple of programs about that here on Ecotopia, where painting is not just about pretty pictures, music is not just about great sounds, but it's a way of putting into action, into language, some of the ways in which we're concerned about environmentalism.
And as long as we're preaching.
We're preaching.
One of the things that my friends who are still teaching tell me is that a lot of their students are not engaged anymore. They don't care what their grades are. They don't care about reading the homework. And it's because they're not engaged. It's because it doesn't seem meaningful and real. And so we are now here preaching a way of improving education by engaging students in real-world projects, in things that matter in their own communities, and teaching all the disciplines as you're doing it. You're not having to have them read out of textbooks because they're learning the principles by doing them and probably developing some principles of their own that deepens learning and that makes learning more valuable and more personally connected. This is Ecotopia on KZFR, and we'll take a break right now and be back to discuss the United Nations Declaration of Universal Human Rights, with Chris Nelson.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR. We're pleased to welcome Chris Nelson to the Ecotopia program today. Chris, well known in our area as an activist. She's part of the weekly peace vigil at 3rd and Main. She also does the peace. I always lose the name of the show, Chris. It's not social.
Peace and Justice.
Peace and Justice show on KZFR. This past weekend, she led a vigil in kind of cold and drizzly weather at 3rd and Main. The participants read the 30 articles of the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights on its 75th anniversary. And we welcome her on the phone today. Welcome, Chris Nelson.
Thank you so much for having me. I love the song that you introduced this with, "We Are All Family," and we are. It's so true.
That was Sister Sledge was the group that did that. We're going to, before we get into talking, you put us on to a clip from UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, just talking about the need for human rights work in our time. So we're going to play that for you now.
The world is facing unprecedented and interlocking challenges to human rights. Hunger and poverty are increasing and affront the economic and social rights of hundreds of millions of people. Civic space is shrinking. Media freedom and the safety of journalists are in dangerous decline in almost every region of the world. Trust in institutions is evaporating, especially among young people. The COVID-19 pandemic has led to increased levels of violence against women and girls. Racism, intolerance, and discrimination are running rampant. New human rights challenges are emerging from the triple planetary crisis of climate change, biodiversity loss, and pollution. And we are only beginning to grasp the threat posed to human rights by some new technologies. These trying times call for a reignition of our commitment to all human rights, civil, cultural, economic, political, and social. The call to action I launched in 2020 positions human rights at the center of solutions to the challenges we face. This vision is reflected in my report on our common agenda, which calls for a renewed social contract anchored in human rights. The 75th anniversary of the landmark Universal Declaration on Human Rights next year must be an opportunity for action. I urge member states, civil society, the private sector, and others to put human rights at the heart of efforts to reverse today's damaging trends. Human rights are the foundation for human dignity and the cornerstone of peaceful, inclusive, fair, equal, and prosperous societies. They are a unifying force and a rallying cry. They reflect the most fundamental thing we share, our common humanity. On this Human Rights Day, we reaffirm the universality and the indivisibility of all rights, and we stand up for human rights for all.
Chris, you've led a number of observations of Human Rights Day in Chico, and we specifically recall a gathering at the Hands several years ago. Why do you think this is important?
Well, I'm reading here, but I believe this too, that this Declaration of Human Rights that was drafted in 1948 is a common standard of achievements for all peoples and all nations. It sets out to define the fundamental human rights to be universally protected, and it's been translated into 500 different languages. It's widely recognized as having inspired and paved the way for the adoption of more than 70 human rights treaties, and it is applied today on a permanent basis at global and regional levels. So for me, December 10th is the most important day almost of the year. It's the day that I am most excited about because it's a day to delve into this and to celebrate it and to share it, because so many people don't even know what a human right is.
Right, right. And so what form does the document take? Is it hundreds of pages?
No, it actually isn't a really long. It's got 30 articles in it, and they can be condensed really easily. I thought maybe we might read them in their most condensed forms tonight, but I just want to define human rights for you, Susan.
Mm-hmm.
So a human right is a basic right and freedom that belongs to every person in the world from birth to death, regardless of where you're from, what you believe, and how you choose to live.
How did it come into being?
Well, you know, it was World War II. We saw horrible crimes against humanity on every side. I mean, Germany with the Holocaust, the United States with the firebombings and the Hiroshima bombing. Japan, of course, had their share of horrible, horrible things. You know, the Mussolini and the Axis powers, you know, I think there was plenty of carnage to go around in terms of guilt and who did what, but, you know, the victors got to decide at Nuremberg. But, you know, I think that everybody at that point was ready for this. And before Eleanor Roosevelt really got this going, there was also in 1948, the U.S. had signed on to an American Declaration of the Rights and Duties of Man, which was called the Bogota Decision, which predated this in the same year. And this was used throughout the Americas. However, this one was much more elaborate and it went deeper. The U.N. Declaration of Human Rights really goes into Social Security in the ways that the other declaration didn't, that was just the United States kind of deciding everybody else how things would go. The UN Declaration of Human Rights is actually a statement by all of the, all of the countries involved. It was really representative of legal and cultural backgrounds from all regions of the world.
So I assume the United States was one of the movers. Who else was strategic in bringing this into being?
Well, I am not an expert on this. I'd have to look that up, Susan. So what I wanted to narrow down into, though, is a little bit about, that's a good question. You might know the answer. Do you want to answer before we move on? I don't know.
We don't know the answer.
We're asking you. You're the
expert. We'll look it up. We'll look it up.
I'm not the expert.
Okay. Now, right. I think, we do, as you suggested, I think we should read it because I think people might be surprised at what kinds of things are included in human rights. What are rights? So why don't you begin, Chris?
Okay, so these are in just nutshells. This isn't the actual text, but it's the right to equality, freedom from discrimination, the right to life, liberty, and personal security, freedom from slavery, freedom from torture, the right to recognition as a person before the law, the right to equality before the law, the right to remedy by a competent tribunal, freedom from arbitrary arrest and exile, right to a fair public hearing.
And I will pick up from there. That was the first 10. The next 10 are the right to be considered innocent until proven guilty, freedom from interference with privacy, family, home, and correspondence, the right to free movement in and out of the country, the right to asylum in other countries from persecution, the right to a nationality and the freedom to change it, the right to marriage and family, the right to own property, freedom of belief and religion, freedom of opinion and information, right of peaceful assembly and association.
And the final 10, 21 to 30, the right to participate in government and in free elections, the right to social security, right to desirable work and to join trade unions, right to rest and leisure, right to adequate living standard, right to education, right to participate in the cultural life of community, right to a social order that articulates this document, freedom from state or personal interference in the above rights, community duties essential to free and full development, and freedom from state or personal interference from the above rights.
Mm. So can I say more about that, Steve?
Please.
Yes.
About the United States human rights record? Because I think that's what's important to your listeners, perhaps.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So, the United States, we all think we're the best, but we are 21st in human rights around the world, and our human rights record includes systemic racism, weaker labor protections than many of the other countries, imprisonment of debtors, criminalization of homeless and poor, invasion of privacy via mass surveillance, police brutality and impunity, incarceration for profit, mistreatment of prisoners. We have more imprisoned juveniles than any other country. We have the continued use of the death penalty. We have abuse of legal and illegal immigrants. We have a healthcare system that favors profit over well-being. We have support for foreign dictators. And in the past, in the recent, very recent past, we've had extraordinary rendition, extrajudicial detention, torture, and black sites with a history of basically state terrorism. So I just wanted to make sure that we got that in there, because those are the bad things. But we have verified many of the treaties that that the United Nations put forward, but the ones we failed to ratify were the Convention of the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, the Convention of the Rights of the Child, and the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. So we, mm-hmm. you know, we have a long way to go mm-hmm. in terms of our participation in the, you know, in the terms of our human rights as Americans.
I have a question that I think about a lot, as having lived for a long, 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 long time now. Is there a pendulum in attention to human rights? Are there times when we've been more aware and more dedicated, and are there times that we've just kind of lost it, which it feels like we're in that place right now? Do you see uptimes and downtimes in the U.S.?
Well, you know, obviously we have just come out of the Trump administration, and what was good about the Biden administration is that they rejoined the U.N. Human Rights Council mm-hmm. in 2021. So, you know, this is a pendulum thing. I think it has to do with who our president is, because they can determine, you know, so many things about our participation with the U.N. But one of the things I wanted to say is kind of the ideals that the ACLU has, I think, would put us mm-hmm. on a more permanent footing if we could do some of these things. They said what we need to do is create a permanent federal interagency body to implement human rights obligations, develop a plan of action to dismantle systemic racism, which is deep here, mm-hmm. and establish a national human rights institution to monitor, document, investigate, and protect human rights. If we had that in place, I think it would be much harder to be at the whims of political fashion.
I wanted to ask a little bit about Trumpism. We talked about it a bit last week on the program. Was there really a pendulum shift with Trump, or did Trump simply unleash hidden hatred, bias, disregard for human rights? I'm trying to get away from the notion that if you just get the right president, suddenly the problems go away.
Well, you know, the rule of law has helped us with some of our basic human failings. I mean, mm-hmm. people, as you know, are somewhat divided right now, because there's so much media and it's coming from all different directions. And the rule of law is really important. That's why control of the Supreme Court is important, because obviously none of this was going on at the time of the Founding Fathers. And so when you have a Supreme Court that's only, you know, originalists, you know, they're not going to be able to make decisions that really represent the best interests of the United States in the current time frame, because, I mean, obviously we are much more complex, we are much bigger, and we have completely different concerns than the founders did in terms of human rights. And so, you know, I think that if we did have some of these things in place that the ACLU suggests, we might be able to, you know, put things in place so that we would all be going in the same direction. And, you know, kids don't learn about the UN Declaration of Human Rights in their schools. They don't know what a human right is. You know, it's not part of the curriculum. So part of it, too, is, you know, that, you know, how much is being taught in schools? You know, how much do we actually know about what our human rights are? And to be able to have a community of Americans who are sort of on the same page, I think we'll get rid of a lot of this division, because it's in everyone's self-interest, you know, to have health care, you know, universal health care, what's happening right now with the unhoused, you know, that is an extreme human rights abuse. Yes. To have people that are unfed and unhoused. And people are accepting of it. You know,
right.
It is mm-hmm. not okay to accept it because it's wrong. And we have to stand up for our values, and we have to determine what those values are. They were set out after World War II in 1948. You know, and if some correction needs to be made, then by all means make it. But I think these are, when they say basic human rights, I think these are the ones. And, you know, these do protect private property. They protect copyright law. They're, you know, it's pretty comprehensive. Who does it benefit? It isn't the people with weird views. It's the capitalists who don't want us to know that we have rights, who don't encourage us to learn about, you know, who we might be, you know, who, you know, how we might be part of a larger community. I mean, it's one thing to live in the United States and have all this privilege, but it's also true that all the other countries and people of the world have the same human rights. And so to stop treating other mm-hmm. other countries like they're somehow second class, or, you know, like, oh, they're never going to make it, you know, they're third world. You know, that is not okay, because we all have these rights. So how can we help one another? You know, we can totally reframe and reformulate our thinking based on these articles of the UN Declaration of Human Rights. And I'm sorry if I went on too long.
No, you didn't go on too long. That was extremely articulate and eloquent. I'm wondering, Chris, how we can act locally to enact these human rights. Are there things that we can do locally to make sure, or to move closer to making sure? I mean, I know all of your work with the homeless and environmental justice, that's the kind of things that you're doing. Are there more things like that that can move us toward a more human rights centered community?
Yeah, I think we have to be more visible. And for many of us, you know, I think that ship has passed. For some of us who are older, you know, we do what we do and we do the best we can, but we're not going to be kind of on the barricades of whatever is next. And so it falls to a new generation, and that generation isn't necessarily, you know, people who are in college, but, you know, the people in their 40s or 50s, you know, who can step up and have some energy and, you know, articulate these things and bring them forward. And, you know, every generation has to be able to turn over the, you know, the hope of the future into the hands that are hopefully reaching out to take them. You know, so it, by articulating our human rights, I am holding out my hand to people, listeners, who care about our human rights. You know, it is so easy just to hole up in your house with your family and your materialism and call it good, but it isn't good. You know, you're a couple of paychecks away, if you're a renter, from losing your housing. You're one horrible medical crisis away from losing your nest egg. You know, it's all very, very perilous, and it's up to all of us, not just a handful of activists, to move the agenda of human rights forward. And I can't stress it enough. I mean, writing letters to the editor and doing the things that we do, you know, standing on street corners is all well and good, but it isn't changing. The needle has not shifted.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to have a new tidal wave, you know, just like those of us who were in the 60s. That was a wave of activism. There has to be a new wave of activism in order to pull us out from, you know, catastrophic climate change, the nuclear risk we're under. You know, there is a lot on everyone's plate right now, and I understand how scary it is. But, you know, folks have got to step up, because this is our only planet, unless you're on SpaceX and you're going to, you know, mine the moon, which is what they're talking about doing. But, you know, we got to work together on this, and we have to have a huge outpouring of care.
Let me just throw in here, both Chris and I are involved in a group now called the Chico Peace Alliance that is newly formed in town that addresses so many of these concerns. And if listeners want to get involved and learn about what's happening, they can send an email to chicopeacealliance@yahoo.com. And we'll get back to you and give you information on some of what's going on locally.
Yeah, that would be great, because this is a new group. Some of us are old-timers from the Chico Peace and Justice Center. Some people are new coming into it. Some are from faith-based communities. But, you know, what we don't have, we're not well-rounded in terms of
no.
age and gender and race. I mean, we have a lot of work to do in order to really outreach to everybody. So please consider, you know, our hands being open out to any listeners, you know, that we really want you to, you know, to help build this so it could become stronger and really effective.
Because of the environmental work that I do, I'm constantly thinking about how can we create this tidal wave? How do we reach people? People, I mean, I think, you know, capitalist materialism has made it so difficult to get people to care about these kind of abstract but real things, because they're thinking about, well, where am I going to get, you know, if I just had this, as my Buddhist teacher used to say, if I just had this, then I'd be happy. It's the next wonderful thing that you think will make you happy, and it never does. I mean, it's never ending. So I want to know what your vision is of creating this tidal wave of pulling in more people and having them care about these basic human rights more than their Tesla.
That's a hard one. You know, in Vietnam, the Vietnam era, we had the twin motivations of the civil rights movement, where people were risking their lives in order to have basic rights to vote and to have equal representation. So we had that going on, and we had a horrible war that was really unjust and seemed to have no purpose and no end. And Americans were coming back in body bags every single day, to the tune of about 300 Americans a day. And there was a draft. So all American families were really, you know, touched by this. Anybody that had a male of draft age was, you know, on tinderhooks about it. So that kind of gave rise to the wave. And, you know, now I don't really know what existential reasoning that people have, why they're not responding more to climate crisis or the nuclear threat with this war in Ukraine, with, you know, the scary stuff that is being threatened between the NATO countries and Putin. But, you know, for my money, the wave should be building now. It may be just building under our feet, and we don't even feel it yet. But it needs to happen soon, because we don't have, you know.
We don't.
You guys know this. It's Ecotopia. We don't have that much time left. We can't wait until, you know, until we can't raise gardens because it's too hot. You know, we can't wait, you know, until there's the first nuclear strike somewhere. It has to be now. So we are the wave. We are maybe just a drop of water, but we are part of this new wave that has to happen.
Yeah.
I don't know what more to say other than that, except we continue to talk about the new wave on Ecotopia, whether it'll be political, whether it's volunteer organizations, and extremely frustrating so for so many people, especially environment. But the nuclear, I'm going to be talking to some fifth graders next week. They did a project on the space age, and I'm going to talk about my memory going back to 1957 when the Russian Sputnik was first launched. I was in high school, and it was terrifying, because we knew not only was Sputnik in orbit ahead of the U.S., but the rocket that put Sputnik in orbit was big enough to deliver nuclear bombs anywhere in the U.S. And that has stayed with us. And what I want to talk to the kids about is my frustration that 60 years, 60 plus years later, we have the same worry, same number of, well, far more nuclear bombs than before, and the risk with something like the Ukraine. All it takes is somebody in Ukraine or Russia popping the wrong missile, and Putin will push the button.
Right.
I pontificate so, again, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I think that's important because in the Cold War, there was a zeitgeist, and it was like, there was a tone, there was a unifying
yes.
tone that kind of had us all, we were all sort of moving together in terms of how we saw the world. And even the media, we had shows like Twilight Zone and Outer Limits, and, mm-hmm. We were all going the same direction, but now there's so much fracturing, in terms of the platforms that we're on and our beliefs and our, what cultural things that we're picking up on. And so it's harder, but I think that as human beings, we all are the same. We haven't changed. We are still biological systems that have the same basic needs. And so if there's a way to bring, heart and mind together and to maybe it's not through fear this time because we've been so frightened so much by so many, maybe this time it's going to be because we love our planet so much and we know that we're going to lose it if we don't step up. It could be a different path forward this time.
That's all we have time for, Chris. Thank you so much. I mean, I think you've made some very articulate and important recognitions, and I appreciate your being on the show and all of the work that you do toward environmental justice, peace, and justice in the community. So thanks for joining us, and thanks for your insights.
All right. Love you guys. Good night.
Mm-hmm. Good night.
Thank you.
This has been Ecotopia on KZFR, exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological. Up next is North State Give and Take with Bobby Tryon. Her guest is Judd Spear, a local muralist and street artist working on love and unity. Next week, we'll have a show on...
Next week, we're going to celebrate early Christmas. We're going to have an interview with... one of Santa's reindeer, and then we're going to talk about the ecosystem of the tundra, where those reindeer hang out.
So join us next week if you want to know, if you want to contact us for any reason, suggestions, helpful things that you can say to us, reactions to our programs. Our email address is ecotopiakzfr@gmail.com. And you can go to our website, ecotopiakzfr.com. I always forget. And thank you for joining us. This is Ecotopia. Up next, North State Give and Take.
North State Give and Take is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Butte College, where your future starts with 3-week classes beginning January 3rd. And they are offered online at the Butte College main campus or Chico Center. Can't join this winter? Spring classes include cosmetology and barbering at the main campus, Chico, and Skyway Centers, and their new Glenn County Center in Orland.